Case number two today is Michael Schreffler v. City of Kankakee. We'll hear from the appellant. Mr. Herbert.
Yes.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dan Herbert, and I represent Michael Schreffler in this case. Respectfully, I would ask for a five-minute rebuttal in this case. To begin, I want to give a very short resuscitation of the facts and the timing. And obviously, if Your Honors have any questions about the facts, I'm certainly willing to offer. But I think it's very important in this case, the timing of some of these issues. In 2009, Mr. Schreffler was hired by the Kankakee Police Department and served with honor and distinction, and it's undisputed that everyone considered him an excellent employee. In February 2016, Michael Schreffler made some comments on a Facebook post that were about a halftime show of the Super Bowl involving Beyonce, and the comments were in poor taste, but they were not overtly racist in any way. Anyways, the issue was brought to his chief. His chief gave him a written reprimand. Shortly after that, Michael Schreffler found out that his supervisor, then Lieutenant Hunt, had made some posts on his Facebook page, which were extremely disparaging posts racially, which showed an animus toward white people. And that's been admitted by some of the defendants here. Mr. Austin, who was a commander with the police department, characterized him as ideology of white supremacy. So
both you, Ms. Ann Schreffler, were reprimanded for their comments, and that was a different supervisor.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. I'm just trying to give a little back frame here. What's important about that is then Lieutenant Hunt believed that Michael Schreffler was a person that essentially outed him about the Facebook posts, and he had made comments to other employees that he was going to find out who did this, and he was going to get that person. So
Mr. Herbert, if I could ask you a couple of questions. Currently, is there some sort of arbitration proceeding that is taking place?
That's a good question, Your Honor. There is. I know that there is discussions about an arbitration. Last I heard, they was probably about 6 months ago where they were talking about settlement. And to my knowledge, and I'm sure counsel could speak to it better than me, but I know that there has not been an arbitration procedure.
So an arbitration proceeding hasn't been formally initiated? Let's start from the end. Has there been an arbitration hearing scheduled?
To my knowledge, there has not, Your Honor. Last I heard was 6 months ago, and they were still up in the air. But to that point, and that's an important point, Your Honor, this arbitration issue is kind of a red herring in this case. The fact here is that there was a choice that was made, and the choice was made by the village to proceed via the board and police commission for disciplinary hearing. They didn't choose to go through arbitration.
But as I understand it, the CBA has post-termination proceeding provisions that would allow, I don't know whether allow is the right word or mandate is the right word, but that would certainly permit an aggrieved former employee to seek arbitration through the CBA with the aid of the union. Is that correct?
There is a provision in there, and I believe that it's either a grievance or a hearing for the board.
But can I also direct your attention to page 52 of the red brief? The bottom of page 52, it's represented in this brief that since the district court's judgment was entered, I'm reading, plaintiff decided to avail himself to the grievance arbitration provided by the CBA. The parties submitted to a binding arbitration on February 22, 2023 and February 23, 2023 and are scheduled to submit closing arguments in writing to the arbitrator by May 1, 2023, just 2 weeks ago. Okay. So either you're saying that this is happening without your knowledge or that it's mistaken or something. I'm having trouble coordinating what you're saying with what this representation is.
Your Honor, I agree. I apologize. I'm not involved in these arbitration proceedings. And like I said, my last knowledge of the issue was that it 6 months ago and there had not been anything pending. Apparently, there was an arbitration. But if I can go back to my point, that really, it's irrelevant to the proceedings here, because not only did the village choose to, they didn't offer him arbitration. It wasn't available.
No, it was his right under the CBA. I'm not sure it's irrelevant, because for purposes of federal due process concerns, it doesn't really matter which vehicle of state law or other provisions, perhaps a contract, is being used. It looks as though he's being given a full opportunity to be heard, to address whatever accusations were being made against him, to give his side of things. I mean, the normal points that you would expect in a due process proceeding.
But I would submit that this is all after the fact. It's all after he was terminated.
Well,
it's after
we
filed
right.
the lawsuit.
Okay. And so I actually looked at this record very carefully from the point of view I think you're now alluding to. Who told him what before the fact? You know, was he given notice of what things he may have, you know, in somebody's view, done wrong? Was he given a chance to say something? And in informal ways, he was. And so informal processes, pre-deprivation, followed by a full-blown formal process, post-deprivation, under cases like Loudermill, is acceptable.
But he wasn't provided his rights, and that's been it's really undisputed, because the Ms. Chief Hunt, Lieutenant Kidwell, Commander Austin, Chief Dumas, they have admitted that he did not receive his due process rights.
He didn't receive certain rights and privileges that local law would have given him, or that the CBA would have given him. And I'm just trying to look at this from the point of view of federal due process, because it doesn't necessarily map right onto every detail of local law.
Well, to the federal question, he certainly has a right to be to answer specific allegations
Absolutely.
Made against him. He was never provided notice of allegations. It's certainly not noticed to the level.
What about when he was given the last chance agreement and he's, you know, he has meetings with people at which he's told, you know, at the training session, there's word that certain things happened, and it's informal. I don't have any doubt that, you know, he's not brought before a formal looking room with a table in it and everybody sitting down, but it seems that he is told what he's done that people are concerned about.
Well, it was much less clear than respectfully what the defendants submit this. The timing of this is he was disciplined and he was fired for allegedly posting information on a Facebook account not related to the incident in the February 2016 Super Bowl. But
I thought he was fired because of the after the investigation of what took place during the active shooter drill.
He was, Your Honor, but what we're saying is that was a made-up reason. It was pretext, and there's evidence in the record to establish this.
Is there any evidence that the commission knew about the Facebook post? I didn't see.
Well, all I can say is that there was a conversation between Dumas and the hearing commission about the charges that were never brought, and I don't know what informal discussions took place. But here, my answer to that, Your Honor, is it was very well known within this county. These Facebook posts created a lot of dissension in the police department and in the village in general. So, one of the commissioners, whose name escapes me right now, he admitted that he knew about these Facebook posts, because the Facebook posts were critical of the the black administration within the police department, and it alleged corruption, and it alleged racial disparity in hiring and promotions. And my point is, and the plaintiff's point is, that's the reason he was fired.
So Mr. Dumas was deposed.
He was.
Yes. And so presumably he was asked what sort of information he shared with the commission with regard to the circumstances that led to the termination. And as part of that deposition, was there any facts uncovered that Mr. Dumas had told the commissioners, look, you know, one of the reasons should be the fact that there are these February 2016 Facebook posts or 2018?
There was no admission to that point. But I would suggest that there are certainly inferences that it occurred. We know that when they brought the charge, which resulted in the termination, the charge included information that shouldn't have been included in the charge, namely discipline that was beyond a certain scope, so it shouldn't have been in the record.
Are you referring, for example, to the reference to the two-day suspension of March 5, 2018?
Yes. And to your point, Your Honor, and I believe that there was information. Yes, there was information about Mr. Schreffler's background, and that included he had previously, just a few weeks prior, been given a five-day suspension for these 2018 Facebook posts. That information, I'm almost positive, Judge, and I can certainly find out, Your Honors, but that was included in the charging docs that went to the commission. Now,
that's what the record seems to indicate, that the charge that Dumas sends to the Board of Commissioners begins by saying this termination recommendation is based on several incidents, and then goes on to indicate what they were: the racially charged language towards the chief, threatening to kill him, name-calling, progressive disciplinary actions, several written reprimands, February 10, 2016, December 21, 2017, March 5, 2018. So the board is told by Dumas of all of these things.
Yes, and thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. And that's an important point here. We know that at the very least, even if we believe all the allegations about the training incident where there was an alleged threat made, which I'll get to that in a point, that there's very significant questions of fact whether that even existed. But at the very least, the board considered this Facebook post from 2018 as part of the reason to terminate Mr. Schreffler. Mr. Schreffler cannot be disciplined for these posts. It's been admitted by the defendants in this case that he posted as a private citizen, and he posted about matters of public concern, namely
corruption. I'm not sure those are full admissions, actually. I mean, that's something we would need to look at.
I would say, Your Honor, that they admitted that police officers certainly have a First Amendment right to post.
But as you well know, there's a lot of nuance in that area of the law, and you look at cases like Garcetti against Sabalos, and you see that even things that look like they're a mixture of public concern and just good office discipline, the Supreme Court has said public employers have to be able to function as normal employers and discipline people if they need to.
Agreed, Your Honor. But I think there is an admission here from the defendants in this case that the Facebook posts certainly were not a basis to terminate him, but also that they were protected activity that they couldn't discipline them for. They gave him a five-day suspension. He appealed it. The mayor sat on the grievance commission, which was unprecedented, and they agreed to reduce that. Actually, they agreed to get rid of it
didn't they?
Yes, to two, and then the last chance agreement. But
he chose unexplained reasons. You don't have to tell me because it's not in the record, but he chose not to go that path.
That's correct. So what the questions of facts here are is, was he terminated basically for the 2018 Facebook posts? The fact that those posts are protected activity, the defendants recognized they couldn't fire them. I'm assuming that they spoke to their lawyers, and the lawyers, like he can't be terminated for this, but he was disciplined for his First Amendment protected speech. And I understand that's disputed, but I certainly think that there's question of fact on that. And
I'm going to need to back up just a minute on the time that we have on the due process. And so I want to give you an opportunity to address this before the other side comes up. Is the defendant's reliance on the random and unauthorized exception, is that foreclosed by our decision, Bradley?
I'm sorry, what exception did you say?
The defendant's reliance on the random and unauthorized exception, is that foreclosed by our decision in Bradley?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor, because in that case, the facts were different. In this case, they were different in that this individual was a chief, didn't have necessarily any contractual rights. He was an at-will employee. In that case, he did have a pre-deprivation hearing with specific notice of charges. He was able to present his side of the story. In our case,
in the Bradley case, there was no pre-deprivation process.
Correct. There was no pre-deprivation process, right. Which in this case, we would submit that there was no pre-deprivation process, and what process there was certainly inadequate and lacking. And I see my time is up. If there's any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Atkins.
Good morning. May it please the court. Michael Atkins on behalf of defendants appellees. I'm here this morning to request that the court affirm the judgment of the district court granting summary judgment in their favor. I had some prepared remarks. I wanted to address some of your questions before I get to those.
Is the grievance and arbitration process still open?
Yes. Here's what happened. And the dates mentioned in my brief, I'm sorry, I don't recall them off the top of my head. The union and the city submitted evidence to a panel of arbitrators. I didn't represent the city in that matter.
Does this begin with a formal request for arbitration? I mean, surely you've got to constitute the panel somehow.
The request was made by the union prior to filing suit. It's in the record in this case that I want to say that was back in 2018, 2019,
okay.
When the union requested the panel. Where the evidentiary gap was at the time of the summary judgment was, well, why did, if that happened, if the union requested the panel, why has there never been an arbitration? Right. And there's no answer in the record.
But the dates you put in your brief, the arbitration is moving forward at this point?
The evidence has been submitted. Closing statements were submitted by the parties, I think on May 5th, which I've reviewed. It's my understanding that the matter is under advisement. I don't think that there's going to be any additional briefing. I don't have any idea of what the timeline would be on the panel's decision.
And what is the relief that the panel is being asked to provide the officer in this case?
My understanding is it would be to make him whole financially to the present date. So it would be back pay, I'm not that familiar with the record. Any value of lost benefits, I would assume, and he's asking for reinstatement.
So I would like, if the parties could do this, to have a status report about the arbitration when, maybe within a certain number of days, do you think?
I think, yes. I think that within a certain number of days of the issuance of a decision, certainly like the parties to file a joint notice with the court within 5 days of receiving any sort of order from the arbitration panel.
Certainly. Was there any other questions on that? No. Okay. Thank you.
What is your view of the record as to what was before the commission with regard to the Facebook posts as it was considering whether or not it should the termination should go forward?
There's nothing in the record that shows that the commissioners were aware of the posts or the content of the posts. In the notice that the chief presented to the commission, there was a statement in there about, I think, the prior 2-day discipline for a prior incident. But that it didn't describe the speech, didn't describe the post. Yeah,
it doesn't seem to say anything about what this...
The sum and substance of the alleged free speech was not described. There's no evidence in the record that the commission had any knowledge of that. I think counsel mentioned something today that a commissioner admitted that he knew something about the Facebook post. If that's in the record, counsel certainly didn't put it forward in his opposition to summary judgment in the district court. And as we stand here today, I'm not aware of where that might be buried in the record. The commissioners were never deposed.
If you don't mind, can we circle back to the arbitration again?
Yeah, sure, of course.
And picking up where I left off in regards to the Bradley case.
Sure.
And so I'm interested to know what pre-deprivation process was provided to Mr. Scheffler.
Sure. And I will... the district court noted it specifically, and although the district court went the other way and ruled the random and unauthorized route.
And I guess that's my question.
Right.
Does Bradley foreclose that argument?
I don't think Bradley
foreclosed. We have here a city that, and so Bradley outlines the when it's a city and what due process is required before we go down this random and authorized act. And so what pre-deprivation process was provided to Mr. Scheffler?
I'm going to quote you back the district court, which I agree with was based on the factual submissions that we submitted for the summary judgment, was that plaintiff was read a notice of the charges against him at an April 18th, 2018 interview. This was the investigative interview with Investigator Bartlett to look into the allegations.
And so they're required to give notice in a hearing. And so is it the suggestion that qualified as the hearing?
There's more. Okay. I wasn't finished. Okay, so he was given the notice of what the charges were at the interview. He was represented by counsel at that interview. He was allowed to give his side of the story.
I'm really listening for where there was a hearing.
There was no formal pre-deprivation hearing. There was minimal pre-deprivation due process in the form of plaintiff being given the opportunity at an interview and meetings with the chief to respond to the allegations that were made against him, which he was made aware of when he sat down for the interview with Inspector Bartlett. He presented
counsel and a union rep with him.
I'm sorry?
He had both counsel and a union rep with him. Is that right? You said counsel a minute ago.
He was represented by a union attorney and accompanied by a union representative.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. So both.
So it's my position that if pre-deprivation due process is required under Bradley, which I'm not entirely sure that it is in this case, that would be sufficient pre-deprivation process. And that is what we argued on the summary judgment. The district court didn't rule that way. There's not much in my brief about it because I didn't observe counsel making that argument before the court. One other thing I wanted to touch on briefly is on this issue of an admission.
Does the amount of post-deprivation process matter if we're not able to get over the pre-deprivation hurdle? After Bradley.
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time?
Yeah. Does the amount of post-deprivation process, talking about where we are as far as the arbitration and those things that are offered by the state, does it matter if the pre-deprivation hurdle is not crossed?
It would certainly limit the scope, I think, of plaintiff's due process claim and his remedies. I'm not necessarily certain that it would. So I guess what you're asking is, under Bradley, if there's sufficient post-termination, but quote-unquote insufficient pre-termination. I think under Bradley, then, it would limit the scope of the claimant, but maybe not necessarily be dispositive of it. I think
there's a lot of law about the interrelationship between pre and post deprivation, and what your opponents say, where pre-deprivation procedures are both required and practicable, then if you don't give them, you may be in trouble. You may have a due process problem. But the degree of formality and the, you know, it doesn't necessarily always have to be a full-blown trial proceeding. That's basically a Matthews against Eldridge point.
Correct. And there was a case that I cited before the district court. Again, I didn't cite it here because I didn't read plaintiff's brief as making this argument. There was a case I cited. It'll be in the appendix in the record on that point. Judge Wood, I think it was one of your opinions, but I can't recall the name of it. Concerning the allegation that the defendants have admitted that the speech at issue here was protected by the First Amendment, I'm not sure where this is coming from, this alleged admission. In the brief, plaintiff points to essentially the part of the record where I raised the Mount Healthy affirmative defense to the First Amendment claim. It's clear from the answer to the complaint that the defendants denied that plaintiff speech was protected under the First Amendment, and you know, notified the plaintiff that that was something that he was going to have to carry his burden of proof on in order to survive summary judgment.
This struck me as a very underdeveloped point, actually. There's a lot of law in this area, much of which was not discussed.
On which point?
The matter of public concern issue in the context of a police department. In, you know, the Supreme Court's been very careful to follow context for this, and I just found it underdeveloped in the briefs, I'll say.
Well, I would say that we submit that the district court's analysis was thorough and correct, that primarily relying on the Clark versus Milwaukee Sheriff's case, or mm-hmm. Milwaukee versus Clark. That
the district court thought these statements were made for purely personal reasons, but surely they were both, right?
I think there's evidence
in a police department is you know, a daily issue in some places.
I think there's evidence in the record that they were made for purely personal reasons, specifically at plaintiff's deposition. When I asked him why he made these statements the way he did, he said frustration. There was no indication that he was intending to air any public issue or foster. You can see from the content, again, when you look at the context of his frustration with the ongoing grievance process he was in for another discipline, that's in the record about when he was disciplined for missing a gun that suspect left in a vehicle.
But that seems like a disputed issue, right? So, I mean, we're here at summary judgment. Summary judgment was granted for the defendants. And so to the extent that we have to draw, you know, view the facts in anyone's favor, it's a plaintiff's favor. And so you're sure. Saying that he, you know, the real reason he posted the Facebook post was personal. He and the subject matter of the post seem to indicate, a more kind of broad subtopic matter than just his own personal grievances with the police department. So isn't that a disputed issue?
I don't think, and I think the case law is clear that the topic in general is not dispositive of the issue. So certainly the topic of public corruption or maladministration of a city is certainly a topic of public interest. I think when you combine the personal motive, the ongoing grievance, and it may be disputed who was right or who was wrong in resolving that grievance, but it's undisputed that there was a dispute about it that the plaintiff was displeased with, and that's what was motivating him to motivating him in his frustration to, you know, call the administration a you know what show, and say corruption ... weird. So I think when you look at that context, or that content, along with the context of the grievance and the, the frustration, you're looking at content and form to determine if we have a matter of public concern under Connick. So I think the district court was correct in finding that plaintiff didn't make that, reach that bar in this case. And I think importantly, plaintiffs waived that argument by not really presenting much, if at all, on that or the issue of Pickering balancing to the district court. Frankly, plaintiff doesn't put much forward for this court on Pickering balancing. I think he only addressed be one or two of the factors. Some he conceded went in our favor. Others he didn't address at all. One factor he claims tips in his favor was that, there's no evidence or indication that this inhibited the plaintiff's ability, the speech inhibited the plaintiff's ability to do his job. But, oh, I'm out of time. I'll stop unless you want me to finish my sentence.
You can go ahead and finish your sentence.
I was going to say that at that point that the plaintiff raises there, the courts noted prior in the Lulowski versus Displains case that part of a police officer's job is to foster goodwill towards the police department. And in light of the comments that plaintiff lobbed out there on Facebook, I think this clearly interfered with his ability to stand out on the street and represent the city that way.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins.
Thank you.
Mr. Herbert, I'll give you a couple of minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
What's important to remember here is what we're looking at, and this is the context of a granting of summary judgment. These issues, the intent of the defendants, whether or not they had a discriminatory animus, those are questions for a jury.
Can I nail down one other point? You started out with some official capacity claims, and they're out of the case at this point, right? You're not really contesting that here.
The official capacity?
Right.
Well, we did contest those because Chief Dumas clearly violated a constitutional right of.
But you need, for official capacity, you need to relate this to the city, basically. You need to satisfy Monell standards.
Well, I think what we need to do, Your Honor, is obviously a government employee is entitled to qualified immunity for acts within the scope, but they're not allowed to.
That would be an individual capacity case for qualified immunity. An official capacity case is the same as actually suing the city.
Okay. I don't believe we've waived those, Your Honor, but I understand the point that you're
okay.
making.
All right, go ahead.
This issue about we talk a lot about the due process claims, and obviously that's a big part of it. It resulted in the biggest damage to the plaintiff, but there's also other claims that we clearly show that that my client was discriminated against, retaliated against, and it was based partially on race. There is ample evidence in the record that wasn't reviewed by the district court in this case. It's undisputed that there was 67 additional facts that were not considered by the district court in this case.
He explained why.
He did. And I would acknowledge that that we probably did not do a great job fleshing out the argument, but you know, Your Honor, as Your Honors know, we were responding to a summary judgment, and the burden really was shifted in this case improperly, and with all due respect to the district court. The defendant had the responsibility to prove that there was no genuine issues of material facts. We certainly could have remained silent without answering anything, and we believe that we should have survived summary judgment in this case, but we did present substantial evidence of a racial animus of the decision makers, and we, there's suspicious timing certainly, and suspicious facts relating to the termination, and these are issues that only a jury can determine. The defendants say it was lawful. We say it was not lawful. A jury has to make that credibility determination.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Herbert.
Thank you.
I will take the case under advisement.